Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. Maybe a better subtitle is a look at our place from space, specifically the International Space Station, through the senses and experiences of one of the world's most famous astronauts, Chris Hadfield. Known for his iconic mustache, the Canadian was selected to the Canadian Space Agency in 1992 and retired from being an active astronaut in 2013. During his distinguished career as a fighter pilot, test pilot, and astronaut, he learned amazing life lessons about leadership and competency that he shared with the public in his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, published shortly after he retired. Hadfield captured the world's attention with his stirring rendition of David Bowie's classic song, Space Oddity, which he recorded on the International Space Station and released a viral acclaim on YouTube. Commander Hadfield joined us from Toronto, Canada, via Skype. Chris Hadfield, welcome to Blue Dot.
My pleasure. Nice to be speaking with you.
I want to start out by letting you know that I have read your book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, a couple of times. And I also listened to it on Audible. And I have to say that the Audible version is just such a joy. I so enjoyed listening to you.
That's really kind of you to say. It was a huge project start to finish. And then doing the Audible version of it, sitting down and actually reading your own book, it's a little bit presumptuous and seems kind of vainglorious at first. But it was a nice way to be able to give the book or present the book to people that, you know, that are on the road and such. So we went ahead and did it. It took me about 3.5 days. But I've gotten a lot of feedback that people wouldn't have read the book otherwise if we hadn't done that. And apart from my stomach gurgling while recording it and having to retake sections, it was a nice thing to do in a small studio in my hometown there in Sarnia. So I'm pleased that you enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, I know how that is, having to re-record things. I will say that having you voice it really made it just so much better than if you'd had a quote-unquote professional narrator do it. Because I felt like I was with you. Because I know your voice from watching YouTube videos and things like that. So when I read the book, I could hear your voice through the pages. But listening to you, it's like you taking us along for the ride on the International Space Station and throughout your life. So it was really enjoyable.
Well, I'm pleased. And that was very much the intent. The whole purpose of the book was to try and write something useful, you know, that people would be able not just to be entertained or just to know slightly more about my biography, but to actually hopefully learn something that would serve them in life or some ideas that they hadn't maybe thought of yet or a way to deal with personal dilemmas. So I'm really pleased that we did the book, and the reaction worldwide has been great. I think it's in 25 languages now and people have read it all around the world. So thank you for reading it twice and for listening to it.
Well, thank you. It definitely kept me company through a few. I remember it was one night I was not feeling well, had a bronchitis, and that book kept me from going crazy. So thank you. Hey, let's talk about your origins, because you and I are the same age and we have many of the same memories. You as a child must have been around age 9, July 20th, 1969. Can you take us back to that small town setting in Sarnia there in Ontario, Canada, and what you experienced and what you remember of the Apollo 11 moon landing?
There was, since we're of the same age, I'm sure it was the same where you were in Southern California, but there was sort of a rising tide in the background of excitement about this race that was going on. And this wasn't a sports race. This was like a technology race. And it was an exploration race, kind of pushing the nation of the United States and the nation of the Soviet Union to their very limits to try and do this thing, to see if it was possible with a brand new technology to safely put people on the moon and bring them back again. Kennedy had cast down the gauntlet in 1961. And it had been a rising fever ever since. And even as a little kid growing up just on the Michigan-Ontario border on the Canadian side, as you mentioned, a little town of Sarnia, I caught some of that fever too. It was an exciting thing as I was becoming aware of the world going on in the background. And the beauty of a race often is that there's a finish line. And that becomes a real focus. Who's going to cross the finish line first? It's a pivotal sort of to human nature. It brings out a certain type of behavior and excitement within all of us. And so for me, at just coming in on 10 years old, this was all the stuff of dreams. This was 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was Star Trek. It was Buck Rogers. It was surreality, but actually unfolding there in front of me. And it very much caught my imagination to the point that, I insisted that our whole family get in front of a television and watch. And we didn't have one. It was summertime. We weren't, we were at a cottage that hardly anybody had televisions, but one of the neighbors did. So we all went across the grove of trees and crammed into their living room and watched something magical happen on TV being narrated by Walter Cronkite. And then, you know, to have it land and then wait and have Neil and Buzz climb down the ladder and step outside and say, you know, Tranquility Base here, the eagle has landed and one small step for man and all that. It was magnificent. It was human triumph. And I haven't looked at the moon the same since. Right? The first time I saw the moon after going outside after watching that on television, it made the moon much more real, much more attainable. A place that people had been, people not that much different than me. And it changed my whole perception of possibilities within my own life. So yeah, it was a major event in forming the adult that I since became.
And one of the big takeaways I got from your book is as a child and growing up, you decided at some point you were interested in flying and you became a glider pilot and then a pilot and then eventually a military test pilot, fighter pilot for Canada. But you decided you wanted to do all you could to be like those astronauts and become an astronaut, even though that really didn't seem, in a way, like a real thing. You still prepared yourself for that eventuality that came your way. And that I found that an amazing, inspiring takeaway.
I did exactly that. I watched what Neil and Buzz and Mike had done in Apollo 11 and then the astronauts on the subsequent flights that followed in rapid succession. And I realized, even at just as I was just turning 10, that they weren't superheroes. They weren't pretend people. These are real people that were actually doing these things. And they had somehow turned themselves into the people that could do these things. They weren't decreed. They weren't somehow blessed with the role of being an astronaut. They had made choices in their life to change who they were, to go do something that up until that moment had been impossible, beyond the human capability. And for me, that felt like permission. And it felt like somebody kicking open a door that could never be closed again. And even though I was in a country of Canada that didn't have rockets and didn't have astronauts, it didn't matter because those people very recently hadn't had rockets and hadn't had astronauts either. It was still a brand new thing. So it gave me the confidence as a young prepubescent Canadian to try and pursue something that otherwise I might never have had the guts to try and go do. And as you say, I learned to fly and went to various universities and became a fighter pilot and then was a test pilot there in California and then a test pilot with the U.S. Navy on the other side of the country in Maryland until eventually Canada did have astronauts. And I got selected as an astronaut and then served 21 years and flew three times in space. Then it sounds surreal, but no more surreal than what the Apollo astronauts had done with their lives.
And your career trajectory reminds me so much of theirs. You really had the right stuff type of the military test pilot. And you were even at Edwards. And I'm curious, have you seen the film First Man?
I haven't seen First Man yet. I did get to know Neil Armstrong very, very slightly. I met him on a few different occasions and talked with him. And I've heard it's a good film. I haven't been to see it yet. I've read a lot of the books and written a few myself. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I understand it gets into the heart of what it was like to be Neil and not just the 8 years that he was an astronaut or the few hours that he was on the surface of the moon.
Yeah, I think the thing that you'll be really struck by is just the realism of what it looks like inside the cockpits of those spacecraft, which, you know, you've had those experiences, you will sense that they went to a great amount of detail to recreate that experience.
I look forward to it.
Well, let's talk about your flights in space. I'd like to know, your first flight was aboard, I believe it was STS-74 Atlantis?
That's right. We were tasked with building the Russian space station Mir, which no one had ever done with a space shuttle before. In fact, the whole idea of docking a space shuttle, an American space shuttle, to a former Soviet and now Russian spaceship was complex and kind of anathema to a lot of people trying to figure that out. And there had been one previous docking in the summertime. But in our case, we were not only going to dock, but we were going to build an entire module onto this Russian spaceship. So pretty amazing task. And it was my first flight, and lots of things to learn. And I ended up being the robotic arm operator on board. So actually physically building this part of Mir and then taking it up and helping with the docking and learning to speak some Russian along the way so that I could be a useful crew member. Yeah, an amazing, complex, high-paced adventure to get ready for that. And then to go execute it properly, one of the busiest 8 or 9 days of my life was that assembly flight, and a tremendous feeling coming home of accomplishment, of having set out basically the proof of what I'd been trying to set out to do since I was 9 years old, and each of the individual tasks working like you're riding this surf on a wave that is getting bigger and bigger and bigger as your skills have allowed you to prevail and do it right. And riding with Atlantis and my crew back down to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, where we took off, and feeling the wheels stop just with a immovable sense of eternal satisfaction and pride at having done something exquisitely hard, something that I had deliberately chosen to be a part of, and doing it completely and well. Just an intoxicating mixture of things for the little boy that still drives who I am.
What was it like that first launch aboard a space shuttle? Because you had two flights on the space shuttle, and we'll talk about Endeavour's flight in a bit. But what was it like for you? What was that experience like compared to what you thought it might be like as a child?
It's many things simultaneously. It's the most complicated flying machine ever built, and it doesn't fly itself. So an enormous amount of complexity and understanding that's needed in order to safely fly a space shuttle. And that's why I was a test pilot at Edwards Air Force Base and been a test pilot with the Navy, and why I'd studied engineering at various universities, was really just to try and get myself ready to be able to go do all those things. So that's the technical mental side of flying a shuttle. So many complex systems. I mean, like 500 switches and knobs in the cockpit alone. But the other side is physical. It's so incredibly powerful and violent, on the order of 80 million horsepower and a wild, heavy vibration. The big solid rockets that shoulder you through the thickness of the atmosphere burn so rough and irregular. You know, they're just an enormous firework. And they are jamming you up through the atmosphere through just ugly, raw, explosive power. And flying that, it's pretty humbling as all of this stuff is happening around you. But somehow you are in this privileged position in the eye of this particular little hurricane or tornado to be able to help it get to space and react to anything going wrong and watch all the automated systems work right, be ready to respond if they don't. And if every second that goes by of this punishing acceleration and vibration, realizing that that's one more second of success. And if we can just get through enough of these seconds, if this vehicle will work and we can make it last about 8.5 minutes, we're going to get to a place that up until now in human history has been basically impossible to get to. And so that long vibration and then the heavy, heavy acceleration, you just feel as an ever-increasing force in your chest. Finally, at the end of it, you're at the right set of conditions and you're just about out of fuel and the vehicle's done its job and steered everything properly and you're above the atmosphere and you're going 25 times the speed of sound and the engine shut off and you're weightless. It's a surreal ride, and you just, everybody laughs as soon as the engine shut off. You know, you look around, you make sure everything worked, you check the immediate systems, check that the speed is correct and there's no leaks in the cockpit. But the natural human reaction is, number one, of relief, which is a bit of an outpouring of emotion, but then just the brand new joy of weightlessness, the freedom of being able to float and fly. It puts a big smile on your face, and yeah, everybody laughs just because it's such a rare and fun and liberating moment in life.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with astronaut Chris Hadfield. He flew in space three times, helping to build the Russian Mir and International Space Stations, and spent nearly 15 hours on spacewalks. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's resume our conversation with retired Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. He's the author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth and a new masterclass on space exploration. Well, and then in 2001, you become the first Canadian to spacewalk to help put the Canada Arm 2. And that must have been an incredible honor for you as a Canadian aboard the International Space Station. But that spacewalk was not without its trauma, was it?
Yeah, on my second flight, as you mentioned, we were on Space Shuttle Endeavour, launched out of Florida again, this time to build the International Space Station. And as you say, one of our main tasks was to put the huge robot arm, the Canada Arm, that's up on the space station right now. We're going to lift it out of the back of the shuttle and sort of guide it up and attach it temporarily, and then unbolt it and unfold it, sort of like, it's like a big dead spider all bundled up in itself, and we need to unfold each of the legs and bolt the legs together and then plug it in and bring it to life. And some of those things you could do with the shuttle's robot arm, but some of them were delicate and finicky enough that you had to go outside and do them by hand, because we don't go out on spacewalks lightly. We don't go out unnecessarily. We'll only go out on a spacewalk if we have to. And in this case, by design, we had to. So myself and Scott Perezinski, another NASA astronaut, had trained for it for years and helped invent all of the procedures and develop them. And on that spring morning, got dressed in our huge white suits. And I was first out. I was the lead spacewalker on my first spacewalk. And the transition is stupefying. To be contained within your own spacesuit, which in effect is a little one-person spaceship, is what it is. It's like a custom-fit spaceship that you have built around your own body. And then depressurize the airlock. So both of you are floating like Macy's Parade floats inside this tiny little airlock, and you're head to toe. I was facing Scott's feet and vice versa. And then I opened the hatch once the pressure had gone to zero and raised it up out of the way. It's big and metal and clangy, but you can't hear a thing because there's no air to carry the sound. So it's bizarrely silent. And then push the little fabric thermal cover out of the way, grab hold of the hatch, the open hatch with both hands, and pulled myself out into the universe. And that moment of visual stimulation, of suddenly being able to just glance around, barely even moving your head, just moving your eyeballs and seeing one entire side of the world. And if you just turn your head a little bit, then you can see that you're otherwise completely surrounded by the universe. It's like if you're in a swimming pool where you could imagine looking up and the surface is infinitely far above you, and looking down and having the bottom of the pool infinitely far below you. And you're there in the middle, completely dwarfed by the enormity of where you are. And that's immediate as soon as you go outside. And it just, it stopped my thought. You know, it just, it would seem like an insult to not stop and notice where your life had taken you and where your choices of a small 10-year-old kid had brought you. And you got a lot of work to do outside, but the magnificence of where you are never leaves you, and it still hasn't left me yet.
Wow. But then didn't your, you had some problems with your visor where it fogged up and your eyes became irritated. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, my visor didn't fog up. And the reason is we put anti-fog on it, like a scuba diver where you spit on your lens. You can get these special chemicals that you can put on the lens of your scuba goggles. Well, we have an astronaut version of that because we don't want our visor to fog up. And it will fog up if you don't do something, because you're breathing right there into the plastic in front of your face. So we rub this sort of oily, soapy mixture onto the visor. The trouble with oil and soap is that you don't want to get either of those things in your eye. And during my first spacewalk, there's a small drink bag inside the suit with you. You can bend down to the right as if you were going to bite your own right shoulder. And there's just a little rubbery tube sticking up. And if you find it and get it in between your lips and carefully bite on it with your teeth, you can suck water through it like a little camelback. Well, mine was failing. It was somehow leaking. It wouldn't give me any water to drink, but it was leaking the water. And so as I was trying to work outside of my first spacewalk, there was water floating around inside my helmet. Kind of annoying, you know, like soap bubbles that you can't brush away with your hand. But one of them somehow picked up a bunch of this anti-fog material, this mixture of oil and soap, and then went into my eye. Yeah, and it doesn't sound like anything horrific, but next time you're in the shower, just shut the water off, lie down on your back and start dripping shampoo into your eye and see how well your body reacts to it. I mean, and the same thing happened. My eye snapped shut. It hurts, you know, that stinging you get in your eye. Your immediate reaction is to try and rub it. Your eye starts tearing up. You sure can't see out of that eye. And the tears pour out from under your upper lid out of the specialized tear duct up there to try and dilute the contaminant that's in your eye. But without gravity, your tears don't drain away. They just stay there. So this contaminated, ever-increasing ball of soapy, oily tear was just stuck there on my left eye. I mean, the real question is, what do you do about it? You're an astronaut. You're outside working, building this thing during a spacewalk. You're alone in the universe. You're only attached to the spaceship by like a little thin clothesline to keep you from floating away. So I didn't tell anybody. I figured, one eye's blind. It'll probably be okay in a while. But the tear got big enough that it flowed across the bridge of my nose into my other eye. And then both my eyes were contaminated and suddenly I couldn't see at all. So now I had to stop work, called down to Houston and, you know, told them I was blind. And then tried to figure out what to do next. And I could have just waited, perhaps, and maybe my tears would have been liquid enough to dilute it. Or I could have tried to work my way back to the airlock, sort of mostly blind, fumbling my way back. But in both those cases, we wouldn't have gotten the rest of the work done. And we weren't outside recreationally. So we hatched a plan together with Houston to open up the purge valve on the side of my helmet to let the air inside my suit squirt out into space. It's a tiny little hole, but it's definitely allowing your precious supply of oxygen to squirt away. And so I did that, popped my purge valve open, and I could listen to my very limited supply of oxygen hissing out into the emptiness of the rest of the universe. And after a while, it did the job whether it was just my tears or whether it was the fresh air coming in through my suit, through its oxygen supply. But eventually, I could start to see again. The evaporation was trading off with my tearing so that there was less contaminant in my eye itself, and my eye started working again, not hurting so bad. And I don't know what the time was, about a half hour, I could see again. And I shut off my purge valve and got back to work. And we managed to finish the entire spacewalk. We were out a long time, almost 8 hours, but got everything done, got the big Canadarm built, didn't hold up the program. And it turned out, at the time, we didn't really know what the problem was. We had some theories. We thought it might have been lithium hydroxide, which is the chemical that removes the carbon dioxide in the suit. And it's pretty nasty stuff. We thought maybe that was causing my eyes to burn. But it just turned out to be the anti-fog. And so ever since then, we've used a much more eye-friendly anti-fog. We just used Johnson's No More Tears, which you know, kind of ironically, we should have been using since the very beginning.
That's one of those things, and until something goes wrong, you don't realize it's a problem.
Yeah, kind of funny.
I'm just curious, knowing your training and everything, did you still try to take your hands up to your visor and try to rub your eyes?
Oh, of course. It's an instinctive reaction. If you feel something hot, your body retracts. Pulls your hand back before you even notice. And if you have a sting in your eye, your hand comes up involuntarily. An infant will do it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, my hand came up to rub my eye and actually bounced off my helmet. I was like, wow, nice trained astronaut, trying to rub my eye through my helmet. But what do you do? And I couldn't reach anything with my eyes. You're inside a fishbowl. So you just kind of had to live with it.
I think we'll excuse you after, many, many generations of human evolution. I think that's pretty instinctive. Before we talk about your last flight, I'd like to get to the part of being an astronaut that not many people think about, and that's the ratio of time you spend training and doing other things to the very small amount of time in your career that you actually fly, because there's a huge amount of years of training and doing other duties, such as, I know you were a Capcom. You were one of the chief communicators to the astronauts on many, many shuttle flights. And you also spend time being a liaison and helping the families of the astronauts who are flying. Could you talk a bit about how much of being an astronaut isn't flying?
Yeah, I think there's sort of a common misperception that we show up, we take some courses, astronaut training, whatever that is, and then you fly in space. I was an astronaut for 21 years, and I flew in space for 6 months. So that meant I trained for 20 and a half years. And it's not just training, but it's also, of course, support of the other astronauts that are flying. As you say, someone has to be expert on the ground, work in mission control, be the voice to the astronauts in space. I was NASA's director in Russia. I was the director of operations in Russia for NASA for a few years. I was chief of robotics for the NASA astronaut office, chief of space station operations for the NASA astronaut office. And all those jobs need doing. It's the spaceship doesn't fly itself. The program doesn't run itself. It takes an enormous amount of work on the ground and in preparation in order to make a space flight seem effortless and inevitable. And so that goes on all the time. And it's also an important part of preparation. If you just showed up on board a spaceship, you'd be useless. All of those years of preparation and simulation and development and support, those are what really get you ready to go do the job well. And there's those people are doing that in every one of the space agencies around the world right now. The Chinese space agency astronauts are doing the same thing, and the cosmonauts in Russia. It's a necessary part of the job. But it's also quite fascinating. You're part of this thing, this program that is doing something that is right at the edge of human capability. And you can go outside at night and watch your product roll by, look up and see the International Space Station go from horizon to horizon in 4 minutes. The brightest star in the sky, brighter than anything except the sun and the moon. And to have an unbeatable feeling in your heart, in the pit of your stomach, that you are helping make that possible. You help build that thing physically, and the work you've been doing on Earth is allowing it to happen at all. So yeah, that's the very much the predominance of an astronaut's life is on Earth, and it's necessary that way. And it makes the space flights maybe even more significant, more precious, more rare, an immense amount of work, but the type of work that I wouldn't trade for anything.
You made me think of just like an analogy is an Olympic athlete that might spend, you know, their entire life training for that one moment of participating in an Olympic event that might only last a few minutes, but, you know, it's all worth it at the end of that.
It is similar. The stakes, of course, if you make a mistake as an astronaut, you die, you know, so maybe it's more like a gladiator. I don't know. But yeah, I think there is definitely a kinship. I've spoken to lots of Olympians. And to some degree, any of the folks in professional sports where you put an enormous amount of work into something for a long time that may or may not ever even happen or that may get no recognition. But then if it does succeed, even then it reaches an end, you know, and it's not forever. And what do you do next? And, you know, you put a lot into it. But flying in space was better than I dreamed it would be. And I had some pretty big dreams. And it doesn't disappear out of your mind. It turned me into who I am, and it's something that has, you know, it's not a job that you had once. It defines who you are for the rest of your life. You're one of the world's astronauts. You're one of the people that has left the planet, and that you know, that tends to counterbalance the what seems to be sort of an unending enormity of work just to make it possible.
Well, let's talk about your final flight, which was the longest one, and you got to be the commander of the International Space Station in 2012, and I believe that what ended in May of 2013?
That's right. On my third flight, because we were going to the International Space Station to stay, you need a lifeboat. You need a vehicle that if one of you got appendicitis or if the vehicle caught fire or had a meteorite puncture us or something, you need to be able to jump in your lifeboat and come home. And so that means you need a ship that can stay there the whole time, not like the space shuttle, which could only stay in space for maybe 3 weeks max. And so we fly up and down on a Soyuz, a Russian-built little ship, and there's a Russian commander in the middle, and then there's a pilot, sort of like co-pilot or whatever, on the left side. And that was my job. So I trained, first I learned to speak Russian, and then I trained to be the co-pilot or the pilot of a Russian Soyuz to fly up. A huge amount of work to learn orbital mechanics and control theory in Russian and to be able to operate and fly that ship. But left out of Baikonur, Kazakhstan, and flew up, took about 50 hours and docked with the International Space Station, and then stayed there for just a little under 6 months. And as you say, took command of the International Space Station for the latter half of my time there to command what is, in effect, the world's spaceship right now. An unbelievable role to be put into, but one that ever since I'd watched Captain James T. Kirk operating his spaceship, one that I'd always fantasized about. Up with a great group of people, astronauts and cosmonauts who you trained with and develop skills with and you know, learn to do things with for many years. Super busy, going around the world 16 times a day, running 200 experiments, keeping this great big complicated ship functioning. Everybody wants a piece of you all the time through all the different mission controls around the world. And you're this weightless juggler trying to put all that stuff together and still not miss the experience, not be overwhelmed by it, still notice what a rare and magnificent place to be it is, and then to try and share it with as many people as possible, not just keep it to myself, but find ways for other people to benefit from this new perspective of ourselves in the universe and occupants of one small round planet. So an overwhelming series of tasks. But at the end of it all, after five and a half months or whatever, climbing back into the Soyuz and flying it home and thumping back to Earth underneath the big parachute back on the prairies, the steppes of Kazakhstan, and looking back on that period of life with a shake of my own head, but also a great delight that this actually happened, that this is something that I had a chance to do, and that that we turned the spaceship over to the next crew in more capable shape and better shape than when we took the keys to it. So a great sense of satisfaction at having done an incredibly hard thing and done it absolutely the best that I possibly could.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll get back to our interview with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. You're listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's resume our conversation with astronaut Chris Hadfield. He joined us via Skype from Toronto, Canada. One of your greatest gifts, you know, from my perspective, is your ability to share those experiences with us here on Earth who will never have that experience. You take us along for the ride. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about your son, Evan, because he really played a pivotal role in making you what I think it was Forbes magazine called you the most savvy social media astronaut ever. Because the tweets and the YouTube videos, I show those in my classroom. I'm a high school science teacher. My kids love watching you wring out a washcloth and see what that looks like, or your description of, you know, why you don't really cry in space, and how you eat and trim your nails and all that stuff. Could you tell us a bit about your son and the role he plays and encouraging you?
Yeah, I talked to Evan a bunch today. Evan had just finished his second university degree, an MBA in Germany, and just as I was leaving for that third space flight. And I was talking to him because they were there in Baikonur in Kazakhstan getting ready for my launch. It was just before Christmas time. And I'd sort of said, hey, social media is fairly new, Twitter's fairly new to me, but I don't know what the capability on the space station is going to be. It was changing weekly as the technology was getting better. I said, I don't know how it's going to work really or how much time I'm going to have, but maybe could you help me? And he said, yeah, okay, sure, I'll try and help you. And that was the extent of our pre-flight planning together, really. But it turned out that the connection was usable. It wasn't continuous and it wasn't high data rate, but I could take a photograph and have it on my laptop and then look at it and just write something really quick, like a little short Twitter comment or something, and then just send it to the Earth. And it would maybe take a little while to get down, depending on when the computer link up was next established. But I could communicate several times a day. And what Evan and I realized was that this is unprecedented. This is a way to share the deeply personal experience of floating weightless and seeing the world this way, like nobody ever could before. It's not like something you read about after somebody gets back, but it's real-time observation and real-time interaction. And so, I mean, I could do an Ask Me Anything on Reddit from the space station, and I could answer Twitter, and I could film something that was funny or sad or unique and make a quick little video and send it down either to Evan or my son or to the crack team at the Canadian Space Agency, and they would take that video and just immediately turn it around and edit it and release it to the world. And it was astonishing to see the reaction. Suddenly, millions of people were on board with us and sharing in the delight of discovery every single day. And that was really nice. On my previous two flights, I'd sort of had to keep it to myself and to just try and explain it with 35 millimeter slides months afterwards when I got home. Not nearly as relevant or as personal as social media allows. And it took a lot, 24/7 work on Evan's part to you know, help me communicate well, to take the music that I wrote and recorded on the space station and release some of those out through SoundCloud. But then also to mirror back up to me, hey, Dad, why don't you try this, or maybe show people this, or you know, be creative in how you're communicating with people. He was an invaluable muse and help, and the results were unmatched. The number of people, even now, they've tripled since I landed. The number of people that are intrigued by the ideas and the echoes of them.
And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about. Were you surprised by the reaction to the most famous video of them all, which was David Bowie's Space Oddity? And I love the way you rewrote it a little bit, because as a kid, when I listened to that song, I always felt sad that the astronaut dies in that story. As a kid, I remember that song, and I love the way you kind of changed it. Could you tell us a bit about that decision, and were you surprised at how well it was received?
Sure. Just a couple days after I got to orbit, it was coming in on Christmas, and my brother Dave and I had written what it might be like to have a Christmas carol from on board a spaceship. I mean, what would Bethlehem look like? You know, all those ancient songs and those particular religious traditions and perspectives. But they've been very influential in the world. And, you know, if you're a star shining in the night and you are that star, you know, how does that change your view of the world? Or after, if you cross over Bethlehem and you could see the whole world in 90 minutes. So we'd written this song called Jewel in the Night, and I recorded it, and Evan released it on SoundCloud. As soon as people became aware that there was someone up on the spaceship recording and writing and releasing music, there started to be interest in me doing a version of an iconic space song, which was David Bowie's Space Oddity. And Evan was keeping his finger on the pulse of all that and sent me a note saying, hey, Dad, you should do a version of Space Oddity. But just like you, I was like, well, geez, the astronaut dies in Space Oddity. I don't want to sing a song about an astronaut dying up here. But it was actually Evan who rewrote the words, my son. He rewrote the words and sent me a good version of Bowie's Oddity. And first I just sang along with it, just like karaoke. And sort of just thinking, you know, fun, little father-son project. But when I listened to myself singing along with Bowie's instrumentals, it occurred to me what a genius he was, or at least what a wonderful artist he was, because somehow he got the feeling just right. The way he wrote it, the chord sequence, the choice of word rhythms was such that it somehow captured how it felt to be there, even though he'd only just dreamed about it. And so once I had this audio track of just my voice, and I recorded it using SoundCloud, using GarageBand. I taught myself to use GarageBand up there. Once I had this audio track, then I put the guitar underneath using a click track. And then I had a friend back on Earth who used to sing in Bowie's band as one of the beautiful women singers off to the side, terrific musician named Em Greiner. And she put that beautiful piano intro in front of my voice and guitar. And then a friend of ours a Canadian down in LA, just south of you, put the rest of the instrumentals underneath, a guy named Joe Corcoran. And suddenly we had this like killer audio track of Space Oddity, what had started as a father-son project. And then we had to decide what to do next. So my son, Evan, sagely weighed back in again and said, Dad, you've got to do a video. You're in space. If you don't do a video, you know, it's just another recording. But you know, I was busy, you know, commanding the spaceship, and we were having a bunch of mechanical problems with the ship. But I made time just shortly before coming back, floated around one Saturday for a couple hours and filmed myself singing along with my own audio track. And then Evan and a friend of his, a little marathon day project, edited it into the final version and got it just done, just under the wire, just before I came home, the Sunday night before we undocked to come home. And we'd had to do an emergency spacewalk, and we were so busy up there. But the night before I left space for the last time, Evan released our version of Space Oddity out on YouTube, and it was just stunning to see the result. By the time I landed, like 12 hours later, it had been seen, I don't know, 7 million times or something. And since then. It's been seen hundreds and hundreds of millions of times. Just on the single YouTube site where Evan posted it, it's been seen, I don't know, 40 million times or something. So it's a real nice outcome of what started just as a father-son project. But I think it also helps people see what life on a spaceship is truly like. It's poetic, it's artistic, it's technical, but it's gentle and ballet-like and thoughtful and inherently human and delightful. And I'm really pleased that that we got the project done and that Bowie liked it.
It's iconic. And there's a part in there, and also in your book, you discuss what it's like. Tell our listeners what the cupola is, and you describe what it's like to be in there with one of your crewmates, that when you're looking through that window back on the world, that you almost, you say you talk in hushed tones.
The cupola, it's a well-known term for architects and builders. You'll see them on churches, of course, and other buildings and ships. It's basically like a bulging window. So you can actually get out into the window to look around. And we thought on the spaceship, you don't just want a flat window where you can only look in one direction. But if you could build a bulging window, then you could look forwards and you could look backwards. And so it took a lot of discussion, but eventually everybody came around that this would be a good thing. And so we mounted a cupola on the space station. Collectively, the astronauts, several years ago. And it's the favorite place on the ship. It's where you can separate yourself from the reality of all of the work you're doing on the ship and suddenly immerse yourself visually in the world and in the universe around it. And there's almost always someone trying to steal a few minutes to get into the cupola to see what's going by. And once in a while, two people are not busy at the same time. And it's such an awe-inspiring place. Maybe if you ever walk into a giant redwood forest up where you live, or into a huge cathedral or mosque somewhere, a great house of worship where the size and the scope of it dwarfs you, that's sort of how it feels, floating into the cupola. And so you do, you speak in hushed tones. Weirdly enough, there's only two of you in there, but you sort of whisper to each other just because you are witnessing something so rare and so awe-inspiring, and seeing things in a way that we've really only just dreamt of for all of human history.
Before we let you go, I would like to know about your masterclass, because when I pop on a Physics Girl YouTube video or anything like that, your commercial pops up. Could you tell us briefly about that? How did that come about? And who's your target audience for the masterclass?
If you have had an experience like an astronaut has had, one of the questions you inevitably ask yourself is, what do I do now that I've completed that? How do I choose to deal with my life experience? Do I just keep it to myself, or do I try and share it with other people, or should I go teach at university or teach at elementary school or run a Boy Scout troop, or what should I do with these things that I've learned? And I've tried to answer that question to myself multiple ways. I'm a professor at the University of Waterloo. I run a technology incubator through the University of Toronto at the Rotman School. I work with space startups and I speak all over the world. I lecture all over the world. But there's such a curiosity and a fascination and a desire to become expert in it that my wife and I had been thinking for a couple of years that we should really do an online class of how do you become a space explorer, or how, what is it like to explore beyond the confines of the atmosphere? How do you turn yourself into an astronaut? And so while we were thinking about that, the folks at Masterclass thought they should do a more scientific topic, not just actors and musicians and movie directors, but maybe technical people. And so they approached me just at the time when we were thinking of trying to do something independently. And it was a delight to be able to work with them. I was down in LA for just the filming was several days, but working a lot in advance, doing all the writing and then writing the workbook afterwards. But I'm extremely happy with the result. A lot of people have learned about space flight, learned about their own limitations or maybe their own possibilities as a result, trying to understand how it all works, put it all into context. The idea is that it should answer all of your immediate curiosities, but it should open up all new ones. And if it continues to interest you, then maybe you should go study it in deep technical detail at a university or something. You know, that's the idea of the masterclass. But at someone at my stage of life, it was such a delight. It becomes almost a legacy work because I've learned all these things. I've gotten to sort of the zenith of my own capability as an astronaut. And to be able to take the time to try and record that with a real top-end production company and let people then access it indefinitely in the future, it was a privilege to be part of that. And I wish that some of the people I really admire in history, Michelangelo or Da Vinci or Goethe or Newton or someone, imagine if they, when they were in their 40s and 50s, had been able to sit down and basically tell you what they were thinking and what it was like to do the painting or the inventing or the discovering that they had done, the thought processes, the human side of that experience. I think it's a nice thing that our technology allows us to do now. And I was pleased to be asked to record that masterclass.
Well, I know what I'm asking for Christmas.
Well, thanks. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you get something out of it.
You know, I've read so many astronaut biographies and everything. Yours really, and I'm not just saying this, truly is my favorite.
Well, that's nice to hear. I'm glad. Thanks.
It's great. And best of luck to you with everything in the masterclass. And go Maple Leafs, right?
Go Leafs. That's right. I'll be at the game tomorrow night.
I was going to say, I don't know what your biggest thrill was, Space Oddity or singing the national anthem at a Maple Leafs game.
Everything has its own thrill. I've enjoyed all of those things. I'm a lucky guy.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Thanks again to our guest, Commander Chris Hadfield. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to us, Blue Dot, on NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. We're produced and engineered by a man whose very name makes you want to look up Sky Schofield. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.